Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Administrative Static. I'm John Vecchione. I'm here with Mark Chenoweth. And our first topic today is Justice Breyer. He spoke at Harvard at the Antonin Scalia. It's basically a speaking symposium named after Justice Antonin Scalia. Back when 2013, Scalia was still alive then, so it was quite the honor. But now every year, a prominent legal figure gives a lecture. And I have to say, I think that Justice Breyer's lecture this year was chock-a-block with a lot of important thoughts and a lot of important arguments. And some of our listeners may not know it, but Justice Breyer used to go around the country with Justice Scalia, and they would argue about the nature of interpretation, because their largest differences were on how you interpret the law. And Justice Scalia is famously a textualist, meaning that the text of either the Constitution or the statute should be interpreted as they were understood at the time of enactment. And there's a lot of reasons for that, that the primary one being that that's the only way you can have democratic control of the judiciary and democratic control of our politics, that words mean certain things, they don't mean other things, and you should use them as they were used at the time. Otherwise, you are, as a judge, importing your preferences into the law. And Justice Breyer believes, particularly in the constitutional area, that it should be interpreted to make sure that its purposes are lived up to. Primarily for him, democracy and equality. So this was famously an argument, and it will always be an argument, I think, in our judicial analysis. But what we have is two very, very sharp legal commentators have written articles, and I want to give full credit where many of what I'm going to discuss today comes from. I listened to the speech by Justice Breyer when it came out, and I might have brought it up previously, but Brian Garner, who has written an extremely influential book with Justice Scalia on interpreting the law, called Reading Law, has written about this lecture because it has been reduced to a book. And the book is The Authority of the Court and the Perils of Politics. And he has written in the Wall Street Journal, September 7th, 2021, a very nice piece on it. For anyone who doesn't want to go to YouTube and watch it or buy the book, it's only 100 pages long. I recommend it. And then John O. McGinnis has written a more vinegary analysis of the justice's comments for Law and Liberty Book Review, September 9th, 2021. And I enjoyed both these pieces very much. And I think they've really summed up kind of where Breyer is and what he's trying to do. And what Breyer's question is something that until recently, certainly when we didn't ask as much as I think we're asking now, which is, why do people listen to courts? Why do the American people listen to courts? How is it possible that the unelected branch says what the law is, you know, and then everyone goes around and follows it? The executive branch follows it. And what Breyer talks about is this was not always so. And he brings up something that we learn in law school about the early court. And there's always Marbury versus Madison. And in Marbury versus Madison, Justice Marshall famously gave Jefferson, President Jefferson at that time, what he wanted, which was to be able to appoint who he wanted and not have the Federalist appointments confirmed. But he did at the same time also confirm that the court gets to say what the law is and can strike down statutes. So that is the precedent. It's practically the first precedent you learn in constitutional law and law school, even though the court had been around for you know many years before that. So so that case was followed because he came out with the outcome that Jefferson wanted, even though Jefferson didn't like the rest of the stuff he put in there. But then fast forward to the Jacksonian period, Justice Marshall finds that the Cherokee, there had been gold discovered on their land in Georgia. And he said, well, look,
that's... Oh, I didn't know that piece of the story.
Oh, yeah. So gold had been found there. And so it happens to the Black Hills later for the Sioux. But basically, gold had been found there. And the state of Georgia wanted to take it all. And the Supreme Court, the Cherokee are not... You shouldn't imagine the Cherokee of the 1830s in Georgia as, you know, wandering tribes. They were settled agricultural, pretty advanced, almost no difference in how they did agriculture or anything else as the Europeans. They had been very assimilated at the time. And yet they were still kicked out because Jackson would not enforce the court's order. He simply said, no, that's not the law. I'm the law. Georgia's the law. And we're not going to have these Indians around here. And that's led to the Trail of Tears. And you read it again. And it's all comes together. If you also, who de Tocqueville writes about this, he then sees it. He's in America at the time and sees this. He's at the Mississippi when they're crossing. So it's a terrible story. So the court, not only was American law violated, and then all these terrible human rights violations happened. So that is a very telling aspect of what happens when you don't listen to the court. But of course, then the court comes up with Dred Scott later. So it's not like the court's always right. But then he points out another case, which was very important. And I did not know it until Breyer did this. And it's in these, both of these. When Brown versus Board of Ed came out, Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne to integrate the Arkansas schools over the governor's opposition.
But Little Rock High School.
Yeah, yep. And Eisenhower was consulting a lot of people, including the former justice of the Supreme Court, the New Dealer. My mind's blanking right now, but he was a just James Burns. That's right, James Burns. So James Burns had been a New Dealer justice of the Supreme Court, and he'd gone back, left the court, and went back to help Roosevelt with the New Deal and the war. And he had been the governor of South Carolina. And he told Eisenhower that he should take the Jacksonian position and not enforce the court's order. And Eisenhower said, I'm not going to do that. And he integrated Little Rock with the 101st Airborne.
Not the Robert Jacksonian position, in other words.
Right, not the Robert Jacksonian. Yes. So it's very interesting. So what Breyer is pressing for is he famously said it was in all the papers that court packing would be a disaster. He said it outright, and it was very important that a progressive or liberal voice, whatever you want to call it, said that. And McGinnis has an estimate. They've evidently done measures of when Republicans have full control and Democrats have full control. And somebody has done the math and says within 50 years, you'd have 50 Supreme Court justices. And it would just look like a legislature. So that was very interesting. But Breyer has put down a marker on why it's terrible and that we are not political. By that, I think Breyer means partisan. What he's trying to explain is that they do not judge in such a way as to get the right the outcomes for the political party that appointed them. And I think to some extent that's very true. But as McGinnis points out, they are often, particularly the way Breyer does it, political, because they are if you are not going by the text, and I'll display my colors here, you've got to use something else. And what is that? You know, if you're using your own views of what advances the Constitution rather than what the legislature wrote down to advance the Constitution. And this tension is always, it's in Breyer's mind too. He doesn't address it always directly. He sort of goes around and round, like his questions in the Supreme Court, sort of a little opaque at first. So he understands the tension of it, which is why I think the book's so interesting, because Breyer wants to keep a progressive form of interpretation, but he also wants to keep the rule of law, meaning sometimes the rule of judges, but really that people follow what the courts say. And it was interesting. McGinnis said that the reason the realist case, they call themselves realists. Everybody wants to be called a realist, right? But
not me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know, but
maybe on some things.
It's just like, you know, I think I'm a realist. I don't think I'm a fantasist, right? I mean, that's the opposite.
I don't know. I heard you're a D&D guy. I don't know about that.
It's true. I guess there, but my goodness. So he's the realist case for the Supreme Court does not and never has rested on the premise that the court is apolitical in the sense judges do not have an ideological or even partisan views. It relies on a comparative judgment. The comparative judgment is that over time, the justices are going to do better than the legislature. But anyway, we'll be back. I recommend everyone get this book, The Authority of the Court and Perils of Politics. Very interesting. I like that.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with John Vecchione. And John, I wanted to talk about a couple of new cert petitions that have been filed in the U.S. Supreme Court. Usually when we talk about these, we're talking about cases that the new Civil Liberties Alliance has filed. But in this case, both of these cert petitions are being filed, or actually were already filed, by the Institute for Justice. But the New Civil Liberties Alliance has joined with a handful of other organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, which I think is a first for us, at least on an amicus brief, the Cato Institute, Goldwater Institute, Law Enforcement Action Partnership, and maybe one or two others on some amicus briefs in support of these two cases. So I wanted to tell you about those cases and then just more generally explore the issue that's at the root of both of them. I doubt very much that the Supreme Court would grant both of these cases, but it might grant one or the other. Coming up out of the Fifth Circuit is a case called Byrd v. Lamb, and that's B-Y-R-D v. Lamb. And coming up out of the Eighth Circuit is a case called Hamdi Muhammad v. Heather Waker, W-E-Y-K-E-R. And both of these cases have roughly the same sort of pattern going on, and I'm not going to go into the facts here. Although I think that if you jump on to read about these cases, you'll discover that the facts here are not good. But both of these are cases where the federal government, a federal officer, has violated somebody's rights, and the question is, and basically in the Fourth Amendment context, the sort of search and seizure context. And the question is, what are we going to do about that? What happens when a federal officer violates somebody's rights? What's your remedy to that? If it's in the context of a criminal act that you're committing or something, we have the exclusionary rule that that courts invented, and that's one of the objections that people have to it, is that it's a court invented doctrine. But the exclusionary rule at least says, look, if you're a criminal defendant and the cops violated your Fourth Amendment rights or some other rights that you have while investigating or while bringing the enforcement action against you or the prosecution against you, then one of the things the court might do is exclude certain evidence from being used against you in that prosecution as sort of a penalty against the prosecution, as primarily as an incentive not to engage in that bad behavior in the future. And so that's one method that is available. But if you are not being prosecuted yourself, say, for example, they were investigating you, John, they violated your rights, and then they realized, oh, actually, he's not guilty. So there's never going to be a prosecution against you where the exclusionary rule could be used in your favor. So what would your remedy be? Well, if this happens with a state officer of one of the 50 states, and they violate your federal constitutional rights, then there's a federal statute called Section 1983 that can be brought that allows you to get money damages sometimes for the conduct. And you can certainly enjoin that sort of unconstitutional conduct, right? You have some options against state officers. There is no similar statute for federal officers, which is a little bit strange. And you may wonder, well, why is that? How did that come about? Well, in the common law, you used to be able to get a state, you used to be able to bring state civil tort damages against federal officers, but that has gone by the boards. Maybe it should come back. That would be one solution to the problem. Although then you'd have federal officers subject to different regimes in all 50 states, which could have lots of problems associated with it. And I'm sure contributed to why that regime went away in the first place. But what the Supreme Court came up with in 1971 in a case called Bivens v. Six Unknown Agents of Federal Bureau of Narcotics was that it was essentially a court-invented version of Section 1983, saying that you can bring an action in federal court against a federal officer who has violated your constitutional rights for money damages. However, ever since that decision, the court has been very busy cabining it to its original facts, right? This was one of the Supreme Court cases from the 1970s, a time when the Supreme Court was inventing all kinds of new rights, right and left, mostly left. And subsequent courts in the 80s, 90s, and for the last 20 years have been cutting back pretty significantly on a lot of that promiscuous rights creation of the 1970s Supreme Court. And so one of the things that's happened in both of these cases, like I say, in the Fifth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit, was that they had fact patterns that really seemed like the kind of fact patterns that Bivens would allow you to seek a federal sort of cause of action against someone. And in both cases, the Fifth and the Eighth Circuit, they essentially shut it down and said, nope, not here, not now, not on this fact pattern. And it's the argument that the Institute for Justice is making is, look, if you're going to say that these fact patterns don't count for Bivens, then really what you've done is said that Bivens no longer exists in the Fifth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit is Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi. The Eighth Circuit is a whole bunch of cases, but it's sort of Nebraska north to the Canadian border and Arkansas north to the Canadian, well, I guess to the, what would be the Wisconsin border, but including Minnesota. So so in all of those states now, this remedy against federal officers seems to have gone by the boards. And so what this cert petition is trying to do is get the Supreme Court to take the case and say, one or both cases, and say, at least we may not be interested in expanding Bivens, but we at least are going to acknowledge that Bivens is here to stay, and we're not going to cut it, allow the lower courts of appeals to cut it back to nothing. And, to be perfectly candid about it, I have some mixed feelings about this. John, you may as well. But my concern is, look, this was a court-created doctrine. And whether it's Chevron deference or other sort of court-created doctrines, there is no statutory support for this. And that's a problem. And, on the other hand, go ahead.
Well, Mark, I think that the problem is because the facts are so bad, these federal officers do something awful, awful. It's usually a terrible, terrible fact pattern, right? They've done something really bad.
And really then flagrant.
There's no remedy. And so I don't think just the judiciary, the American people don't like it either. It sounds wrong. It sounds wrong that they know they can sue their state officials and they can't sue their federal officials. The answer, of course,
turns the Constitution upside down, right? Because the Constitution was there to cabin the federal power, not to cabin the state power so much.
Right. And so the justification is, hey, we're the courts. We're not going to be parties to this kind of outrageous behavior. Therefore, we've created this doctrine. But there's not supposed to be federal common law. If they were federal common law courts, this problem might fly a little better. But I think now it's going to be stare decisis to beat the band, right?
That's right. I mean, I think that's right. But in the Fifth and Eighth Circuit, stare decisis wasn't enough. I mean, they cut back on what the previous state of the law was in both of those circuits in order to further reduce the footprint of Bivens. And yeah, I guess where I come down at the end of the day and then jump in, John, but I feel like if they're going to cut back Bivens this much, and I understand the arguments the judges are making in the Fifth and Eighth Circuit, they really need to wait until there's something else to replace it, whether that's a legislative solution or whether the Supreme Court replaces it and says, hey, we're going back to the common law way pre-Bivens, where you could bring actions against officers based on state tort law. But there has to be something. Otherwise, you're just empowering the administrative state to violate people's civil liberties with impunity. And that's certainly the opposite of what NCLA stands for.
Yeah, and I have never looked at the original meaning of state law being used against federal courts. I know they're immune. I know federal officers are immune, but is that because of statute or did they just say it's the nature of the Constitution that it can't be done?
That's a great question. And I don't know the answer offhand. I mean, we didn't get into that in the amicus brief. So I haven't brushed up on that recently, but you're asking the right question for sure.
Yeah, because it would be something if an originalist court finds that, oh, no, they always meant to do this.
Yeah, ever since 1971. I mean, 1791. No, 1971. No, 1791. Yeah. Which one is it? Yeah. So I commend these cases to you. Hamdi Mohammed v. Heather Waker out of the Eighth Circuit, as I mentioned, and then Bird v. Lamb out of the Fifth Circuit. In fact, I would commend you to go read the Fifth Circuit and Eighth Circuit opinions in these cases. You can, if this is a debate that's of interest to you, particularly the Fifth Circuit opinions. I think it was Judge Willett maybe who wrote, if I'm remembering correctly, and they really talk about some of the problems with the Bivens doctrine. But I think what they don't necessarily completely explain is what the situation would look like if Bivens went away and there were nothing to replace it. And that's the world that I'm a little bit afraid of, John. And that's one of the reasons that we jumped on these amicus briefs with other folks, encouraging the Supreme Court to take one or both of these cert petitions from the Institute for Justice. So we'll see what happens.
And, you know, the other thing is you always have to wonder in our position whether you bring a Bivens action because you don't want to cut back. Right. You really want to keep it in the lanes. And it here that the appellate courts are cutting back. They're not supposed to cut back on Supreme Court precedent. They're supposed to follow it.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. And we have brought Bivens actions. We brought one in against the IRS over what we think was an illegal search related to Bitcoin that one of our clients had. And, you know, so we're not, Bivens is a, it may not be our favorite tool in the toolkit, but it's a tool in the toolkit. And unless and until the Supreme Court takes it away, we need to be able to use it in order to protect people's civil liberties against overreach by administrative agencies. And I really don't like using the word overreach, as John knows. But if a federal officer violates your civil liberties, there needs to be a remedy. And I don't love it that Bivens is your remedy, but better Bivens than nothing. We'll be right back.